Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
I'm not arguing for cutting off aid to Israel. I do think that aid should be conditioned on certain types of behavior by Israel that would be conducive to U.S. interests.
The war in the Middle East is grinding down both sides, and it's not doing the U.S. any good either. Tuesday, December 12th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, military analyst Andrew Bacevich says Israel's war on Hamas is doomed, and the U.S. should rethink its policy. Also, we meet one of the young Palestinian men who was shot in Vermont over Thanksgiving weekend.
It's very hard for Palestinians to find an area just where they could feel safe. And when we seek refuge somewhere else, it seems like the hatred has transferred there as well.
But first, if Kate Cox doesn't qualify for a medical exemption to Texas's abortion law, then who does? That's the question now that the Texas Supreme Court has denied her request for an abortion, even though her doctors recommended it. By the time the court issued its ruling, Cox had already announced she was leaving the state to get the abortion. Her fetus had an abnormality that is almost always fatal at birth, and doctors had said that carrying the pregnancy to term could harm the mother's health and fertility. But that doesn't matter, according to the court, because the pregnancy was not life-threatening. For a look at what this case means, we called up Kim Mutcherson. She's a professor of law at Rutgers, and she spoke to Scott Tong.
Kate Cox asked for an exception to the abortion ban in Texas. She argued her own health was at risk. But the state Supreme Court said her doctor, quote, could not or at least did not make clear that this met the law's exceptions. Help us understand the court's reasoning here.
Absolutely. So the language of the statute is very specific. It requires that the physician has to say in her reasonable medical judgment that there is a life-threatening physical condition, and it's very clear that it has to be a physical condition that's aggravated by or caused by or is arising from the pregnancy, and it places the pregnant person at risk of death, or it poses a serious risk of substantial impairment of a major bodily function unless the person gets an abortion. So basically what the Texas Supreme Court says is the language that was used both by Dr. Carson, the physician, and by the judge down below doesn't track the language of the statute. So yes, the court order from down below from the trial court says, yes, it was good faith, and yes, says that it was a medical recommendation, but it doesn't use that sort of magic language.
So trying to understand the upshot here. Is it clear then in Texas what patients and doctors would have to do or say in cases seeking abortion procedures?
It's clear what this Texas Supreme Court expects, and the court even says like that it's not taking the position that this is not a case in which a medical exception might be appropriate, but that wasn't sort of established by the doctor and by the judge in the trial court. So what the Texas Supreme Court wants to see is the language. You have to specifically say that this is life-threatening. You have to specifically say that you are making this diagnosis under your reasonable medical judgment. You have to specifically say, you know, what the risks are. And if you don't do that, then they say the exception can't apply.
I see. And so just to make sure to understand, the court did note that under certain conditions, abortions are allowable under the state law?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there have been abortions in Texas post-Dobbs. You know, the problem, of course, is that the legislature didn't do a very good job of helping people understand just how broad or narrow the exception is. So one of the other things that the Supreme Court did that hopefully will be useful for physicians and for pregnant patients in Texas is they said, one, it doesn't require imminence. So it doesn't have to be, you know, you're right at death's door before you can get that abortion. It says it doesn't require medical certainty. And they also said that it doesn't require a court order. So all of those things should put physicians in a better position in determining whether there's a medical exception.
Hmm. And effectively, does this mean that in Texas, patients and doctors will have to make individual cases to the courts one at a time?
It doesn't. I mean, the court specifically says you don't have to have a court order, that judges shouldn't be making these decisions, that these are decisions that should be made by physicians. Now, why then would these folks come to court? Well, you come to court because you don't trust, right? You don't trust Ken Paxton. You don't trust exactly
the
how
– the state attorney general.
Exactly. You don't trust how the medical exemption is going to be interpreted once you – you know, if you do end up in criminal court and you're facing losing your medical license or going to prison for decades, you want to be pretty sure that you're not going to be successfully prosecuted. So the Texas Supreme Court says you don't need to get a court order, but if you want to really be safe, going to court and getting a court order is what you would do.
Yeah. And what are the implications going forward for doctors and hospitals? You mentioned the Attorney General Ken Paxton. He stated in the course of this that any doctors or hospitals involved in an abortion for Kate Cox would face civil and criminal liability.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that Ken Paxton, his preference is for not a single abortion to happen in the state of Texas. And it's really important also to remember here that this, even though we've talked a lot about the fetal anomaly, and that's the, you know, why this discussion about abortion started, that in and of itself is not a reason to have an abortion in Texas. So Texas is really focused on making it as difficult as possible for someone to be able to terminate a pregnancy. So it doesn't matter if you're going to have psychological harm. Doesn't matter if you have mental health issues. It doesn't matter if you're going to spend 20 weeks of your pregnancy carrying a fetus that you know is not going to survive. None of that matters. It has to be that you have a life-threatening physical condition.
All right. Kimberly Mutcherson, law professor at Rutgers. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, historian Andrew Bacevich writes that the Israel-Hamas war will end in failure for both sides, and he warns that the U.S. should have learned its lesson by now about getting enmeshed in the Middle East. Robin Young picks it up after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares how cash can be part of a balanced savings strategy for investors.
Oftentimes people think of their cash as the money they're using, but when there's a high rate environment, your cash can also be a form of savings. So savings can sit in your cash account and savings can sit in an investing account. And on average and over time, investments go up, but in a high interest rate environment, you can get a more predictable return in a high yield savings account. And so investors can choose both strategies, an investment strategy as well as a cash strategy, to both protect your principal because cash doesn't go down the way markets can, but also to earn a high yield.
Learn more about high yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk, performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Osea. Their Mega Moisture Duo features two of their clean, vegan bestsellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com.
In this moment, with a Mideast war launched by a horrific attack, followed by a punitive bombing response, we've been thinking a lot about retired Army Colonel and historian Andrew Bacevich. He served in Vietnam, is professor emeritus of history and international relations at Boston University, someone who would never call himself a liberal, but an early and lonely voice against U.S. invasions in Afghanistan and Iraq. Not just because his son died in one of those wars, but because it wasn't sound strategy. We spoke a lot and wondered how he feels now. Well, he writes in a piece in Commonweal magazine, "The Israel-Gaza War Will Fail." He also questions U.S. policy in the Middle East, comparing it to a carcass in an advanced stage of decay. Professor Bacevich is chair and co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks so much.
We have been thinking about you. And just to give newer listeners a little reminder of why, in 2015, we spoke about your longstanding opposition to the Iraq War. Let's listen.
The reason ISIS exists is because the George W. Bush administration introduced U.S. forces into Iraq in the first place. More broadly, our Iraq War, or Bush's Iraq War, broke Iraq, ended its stability. And ISIS is simply a symptom or a manifestation of that instability.
So, Andrew Bacevich, we were thinking of those words. We are thinking, and we're only going to mention it one more time, of your son dying in 2007 in that war, Andrew Bacevich, 27 years old. We always wondered how you remained so calm, but I'm wondering now what you thought when President Biden, just after October 7th and the Hamas attack in Israel, when he said to Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel, "Don't repeat the mistakes we made in Iraq and Afghanistan." I'm wondering what you thought, because there are several living presidents, including George W. Bush, who were responsible for that war or carrying it out.
What I thought was that Netanyahu probably didn't hear or take seriously what Biden said, that is to say, Biden's warning. The horror of the October 7th attack, I think, was such a shock to the Israeli public that they're not in the mood to listen very carefully to warnings to exercise some restraint. So they have embarked upon this all-out war to destroy Hamas. And I fear that it's going to fail. And I also fear that at some point we may be drawn into it.
Okay, well, you mentioned that shock. We're familiar with it because after 9/11, it was that same feeling of shock. And I remember voices trying to cut through that to say, yes, but just because Osama bin Laden is in Afghanistan somewhere, perhaps attacking Afghanistan is not the best idea. Anthony Cordesman was one of those who cautioned against it. So we've been in that same place. And I guess I'm just saying, did you feel some validation because, you know, voices like yours as the war went on just were not heard?
Oh, I don't feel validation. What I feel is enormous sadness, because it just seems to me that governments, I don't mean just our government, just the Israeli government, but governments seem to have a difficult time grasping how little war can accomplish. I'm not a pacifist.
Yeah.
I understand force has a place in international politics. But the notion that you can go to war and fix your problems is exceedingly dangerous. That is what we did after 9/11, to very little benefit and great cost. And I think that's what the Israelis are doing right now as well. The Israeli government has not identified a plausible endgame, a political purpose that Israel intends to achieve. If the declared purpose is to eliminate Hamas, that just ain't going to happen.
Mm. But you also say you agree that Israel has a right to defend itself. So how would you suggest the path go?
My suggestion is utterly banal, although I'm sincere in this, and that is that there will be no peace until there is a two-state solution.
But Hamas doesn't want a two-state solution. They don't want Israel to exist, unlike some of the other Palestinian factions.
And that, sadly, I think is why we are doomed to have this war continue in perpetuity, because there's such an absence of willingness on both sides to acknowledge the legitimacy of the ambitions of the other side. Mm. And while in an immediate sense, Israel is infinitely stronger militarily than Hamas, the issue ultimately is not a military one. It's a political one. But I see no sign that any government of Israel is willing to concede that basic point.
And we should say that past Israeli governments have been very much for and have worked towards a two-state solution. This particular one, the Netanyahu government, has shown no signs of interest in that. So here we are. And that brings you to your other conclusion, which is that the U.S. has to change its policy in the Middle East and towards Israel. How so?
Well, I would say that for the past several decades, successive administrations have believed that the effective use of military power, either directly or indirectly, can somehow bring about a political settlement of all that ails the Middle East. We have fought several wars with that notion in mind, but it doesn't seem to me that there's any indication that the exertions of the United States and the blood shed by the United States is bringing the Middle East any closer to any kind of settlement. Therefore, our emphasis on military power as the key instrument, I think, has taken us down the wrong path.
Giving aid to Israel, that kind of military power.
And aid with basically no strings attached. And that's what Biden did again after October 7th. I'm not arguing for cutting off aid to Israel. I do think that aid should be conditioned on certain types of behavior by Israel that would be conducive to U.S. interests. But an open-ended war, an obliteration bombing campaign in Gaza, is absolutely contrary to U.S. interests, and I would argue it's also contrary to Israel's interests. But as long as we keep issuing blank checks, then the leverage that the United States has available vis-a-vis Israel is going to be limited, and people like Netanyahu are going to drive the train.
Yeah. You've got plenty of criticism to spread around here. It wasn't just Netanyahu that was ignoring the plight of the Palestinians and the need for a two-state solution. It was U.S. officials who just kind of had consigned Hamas to an afterthought. You say Israel's fury directed at Hamas is understandable, but vengeance is a poor substitute for strategy. And most of all, you seem to be saying that what happens in the Middle East with Israel is not as much in the American interest as American officials think it is?
That's my belief. Yeah. I mean, the assumption is that the Middle East is a place where we have vital interests at stake. That notion originates back in the 1970s. You and I will remember that in the 1970s, our economy was dependent upon foreign oil. Well, it's not dependent on foreign oil. The original argument for why the Middle East and the Persian Gulf were so important to us simply is not valid. Mm. I would argue that the most important threat to U.S. national security is climate change. But for even people who don't think that climate change is a pressing concern, it's clear that East Asia is regionally much more important than the Middle East is. Yeah. I hope to heck that we don't end up in a war with China, but coming to some sort of reasoned settlement in U.S.-China relations is a heck of a lot more important than anything going on in the Middle East.
What about the Middle East politically? The Jewish population that is looking to Joe Biden to support Israel in defending itself. Many Americans of color who are looking for finally a solution for the Palestinians. If they do not vote for Joe Biden, you have a Donald Trump who absolutely, from his past comments, would be backing a Netanyahu continued war.
You put your finger on a very important point, and that is the domestic political implications of this entire crisis. The one thing I would say that keeps me awake at night is, should the United States allow itself to be drawn into this war as a combatant? And let's remind ourselves that U.S. forces in the region, in Syria, in Iraq, in the Mediterranean, have come under fire lately. Should that lead to direct U.S. military combat involvement in the ongoing Gaza-Iraq war, then my guess is Trump will win the election, because he will capitalize on that as further evidence, from his point of view, of Biden's incompetence. It would be the withdrawal from Afghanistan all over again. And he will whip up his followers using the war as an argument for why he deserves a second term. The argument, from my point of view, doesn't even pass the laugh test. But I think that in some senses, that describes the essence of the precarious situation we are with regard to our domestic politics.
That is retired Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich. He is chair and co-founder of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Andrew Bacevich, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Scott speaks with one of the Palestinian students shot in Vermont last month. Kenan Abdelhamid is recovering, and he says when people dehumanize Palestinians, the result is senseless violence. More when we return.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Viore.
Jump into a new perspective on performance apparel. Vuori makes products that stand the test of time and hope to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives, empowering your best life in clothing that can be worn for just about any activity, from running to yoga. Visit Vuori.com/NPR to receive 20% off your first purchase and enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75. Discover the versatility of Vuori clothing. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Over Thanksgiving, three college students of Palestinian descent were shot in Burlington, Vermont, when they were out walking. The three friends say they were speaking a mix of English and Arabic when the gunman fired. They all survived, but at least one was seriously wounded. We're going to talk now to one of them. Kinan Abdelhamid says that day he saw his friends hit the ground and he sprinted to a nearby house asking people to call 911. The suspect, Jason Eaton, has pleaded not guilty to second-degree attempted murder. Abdelhamid is a U.S. citizen and a junior studying pre-med at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. We should say the Justice Department is looking into increased reported threats to Muslim, Arab, and Jewish communities in the midst of the Israel-Hamas war. Kinan, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How are you doing physically? It's only been 2 weeks, right, since you were shot in the glute that horrible day.
Physically, I'm recovering quite well, so I'm really thankful for that.
Yeah. How about emotionally? I read that even that, you know, knock of a door can be upsetting and totally understandable.
I mean, yeah, emotionally, in terms of the PTSD and the being unsettled from noises and movement, it has gotten a lot better. However, in terms of just general emotion, right now, me and my friends are very focused on what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza, just like witnessing an ongoing genocide has been like documented by every human rights organization. And it not being stopped is something extremely psychologically taxing, especially while we are recovering and for other Palestinians as well.
Yeah. And your friends, of course, it was the three of you walking that day right around Thanksgiving. How are Hisham and Tahsin doing?
Hisham is still recovering in the hospital. Tahsin, it seems to be doing all right. I can't really say much more about them because it's they're recovering their own journey. So,
understand. Okay, sure thing. Now, local authorities, federal authorities are investigating whether the incident may have been what's called a hate crime. The suspect, Jason Eaton, has pleaded not guilty to second-degree attempted murder. But in your mind, was this attack because you were walking and speaking this mix of Arabic and English? Two of you were wearing the black and white scarf of Palestinian identity and solidarity.
I mean, it's really hard to see how it could be anything else. Regarding whether the police are going to call it a hate crime or not, in the law, it takes a lot more evidence, especially to establish motive for a hate crime. So you're going to have to find text. You're going to have to find some digital evidence. But it's very easy to have a hate crime happen and it not be called that under the law, whether the police see that or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the three of you, you and Hisham and Tahsin, the three of you, came to the States for college, all brainiacs. You all went to the Ramallah Friends School, a private school in the occupied West Bank, before coming to the States. I want to ask what daily life was like in the West Bank for you and your friends on a daily basis. Did you think much back then about physical security?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that question. Living the West Bank is awakening. You see one reality and then you see another reality mass reported around the world. Living in the West Bank is not easily, especially in areas like Jenin. It is not uncommon for soldiers to come and excavate neighborhoods to make more space for the state or to shoot children with no justification. And it's not uncommon to have the ambulances blocked, mass imprisonment with no sentencing. These are lived realities for Palestinians. And yeah, it has been the case for many, many years.
And how about for you? Do you have a memory of what you're describing under occupation?
I have a friend that it's around 10th grade. He was shot for protesting in the ankle with live ammunition. I have another friend that was shot with a rubber bullet, well, an illegal rubber-coated metal bullet. And usually they were aiming for the knee to permanently like incapacitate him.
Hmm. So you and your friend, you graduate, from that elite school in the West Bank. You come to the U.S., where we learn your mother assumed it would be a safer place. And now, my goodness, now this, you know, my daughter is exactly your age. This is unimaginable for a parent. How is your mom doing? How are your parents doing?
My mom is recovering slowly. It's hard to say exactly how. But it's very hard for Palestinians to find an area just where they could feel safe. So kind of our home is actively being eaten up, and it has been for the past 75 years. And when we seek refuge somewhere else, it seems like the hatred has transferred there as well.
Yeah. You seem really active at Haverford College, pre-med student, you're on the track team, you're working, I read, as an emergency medical technician. You know, until this incident over Thanksgiving, can I ask, what was it like kind of being a Palestinian-American student at Haverford College?
Regarding the college campus, I feel even more supported by the students. In America, I feel less safe generally outside that bubble.
Yeah, can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, it feels like there's, it feels like Palestinian voices aren't just allowed to be heard. And me, and not just me as an individual, but as a collective. And if their perspectives aren't allowed to be heard, you just kind of have this image of every Palestinian as a horrible person. And that's just not the case. It's really important before taking action against Palestinians or speaking about Palestinians to at least speak to a Palestinian and hear out their perspective, because a lot of times what you hear isn't the truth.
Yeah, I'm curious how those conversations go. You have the opportunity to be the Palestinian, to speak to Americans encountering speaking to a Palestinian for the first time. What are the biggest misconceptions Americans have that you often talk to?
Well, firstly, being Palestinian does not automatically mean you're Muslim. And being Muslim does not automatically mean you're a terrorist. So there was, especially before the establishment of Israel, but still after, significant portion of Palestinian Christians and a significant portion of Palestinian Jews. Just like any other population, we're not one homogenous entity. We don't all have one goal. We don't all have one mindset. We're just like any other people. And the fact that we've all been painted as this one aggressive entity that, frankly, is evil and deserves to die, contributes to the systematic dehumanization that not only got me shot, but got a Palestinian here stabbed, and other Palestinians I know beat up. It's very important to listen to a Palestinian voice because, again, most Palestinians are experts on their history and the subject because our identity has been tried throughout history to be erased many, many times. So a lot of Palestinians did fight for that identity over and over and over again. So they're very aware of the history, and they're not coming from malice. They're just coming from a humanitarian perspective.
Yeah. Well said. You speak well, represent well. Finally, Kenan, you're a junior in college at Haverford. pre-med student. What's next for you, next couple of years?
I'm looking forward to becoming either a doctor or physician's assistant, and I really enjoy helping people. I used to volunteer in ambulances in Palestine that delivered medication to poor Bedouin children. I think that's what really sparked my interest in medicine. I'm looking forward, if we have a homeland by that time, to go back and help those children have the medicine they need to survive.
We've been talking to Kinan Abdelhamid, one of three college students of Palestinian descent shot in Vermont last month. Kinan, it's great to hear you're doing better, and thanks so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. And if anything, I hope this radio call could kind of be a call for action for other institutions to humanize Palestinians more.
That's our show. It comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by James Mastromarino, Adeline Sear, Jill Ryan, and Koyami Saxena. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. You know, if you like this show, the best thing you can do for us is recommend Here and Now anytime to a friend or someone you know who you think might like it. If you've done that lately, or you plan to, thanks. And either way, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This election season, you can expect to hear a lot of news, some of it meaningful, much of it not. Give the Up First podcast 15 minutes, sometimes a little less, and we'll help you sort it out, what's going on around the world and at home. Three stories, 15 minutes, Up First, every day. Listen every morning, wherever you get your podcasts.